This episode is presented by Invest Puerto Rico. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Hello and welcome back to Equity, a podcast about the business of startups where we unpack the numbers and the nuance behind the headlines. My name is Alex and I'm joined by my buddy in crime. It's senior TechCrunch reporter on the FinTech beat, Mary Ann Azevedo. Mary Ann, hello. How are you?
Hey, Alex. How's it going?
You know, I'm taking Friday off. So yay. I am clicking my final buttons and pushing my final screens around and then I'm going to go dissolve into a puddle of mush on the floor. I can't wait. It's going to be fantastic.
I'm excited for you.
But I will be back on Monday, which means more equity, which means we need you to drop us a review. So if you get a chance on whatever podcast streaming service you are using, go ahead, drop us a review, drop us a star rating. If you have nice things to say, please go on at length. If you have mean things to say, well, I don't know, keep it brief. Anyways, we appreciate you very much. And on the show today, deals of the week from PayJoy and Proxima Fusion, then a rising theme of startup acquisitions, and then finally, do Latin American startups even need YC anyway? All right, Mary Ann, we're starting off with PayJoy, and I gotta say, this company was not what I expected, and it's much cooler than I thought.
Really? Okay, that's a good thing. I thought it was cool too, Alex. So it wasn't like a funding round piece, but they did share with me that they had reached annualized revenue of $300 million last year. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot. So what do you do exactly? And the more I heard about it, the more intrigued I was. So this company has actually been around for about 9 years. It became a public benefit corporation last year. So what they do is they actually started out offering people in emerging markets a way to get smartphones and at the same time build credit. So interestingly, this evolved over time. And about 4 years ago, the company decided to evolve. It was called buy now, pay as you go model, by the way. So that there were people who don't have credit by allowing them to purchase smartphones, pay weekly for like a 3 to 12 month period. So about 4 years ago, they decided to evolve this into also offering them a way to borrow money by using those phones as a collateral for a loan.
And this is what I thought was really, really smart. By the way, buy now, pay as you go works out to BNPAYG, which is not really a great acronym. So I am not in love with the branding, but the idea here is great. And Mary Ann, you start the story with a look at someone who lost their phone and they wound up not being able to get paid. But with PayGo, they were kind of able to at least access a device to let them access their money. But I can see how there's kind of a bootstrap issue there of if you don't have a phone, you can't get paid. And it's interesting.
Yeah, sort of. So what happened was a mother of two who worked at a supermarket in South Africa had her phone stolen. And so she was without a mobile phone for about 9 months. She couldn't afford a new one. And then she saw a sign about PayJoy and then was able to get her first smartphone. And, you know, that was a big deal for her. She never had an actual smartphone. You know, her first phone was not a smartphone.
Got it.
Yeah. So the thing is, I mean, she was building her credit. So at some point, if this mother of two decided she wanted to borrow money, she would, depending on her credit worthiness, of course, she would be able to apply for a loan through PayJoy and use that phone as collateral once it's paid off, of course. So I know it sounds a little complicated, but it's not so much. And they claim that they use machine learning and different data tools to assess credit worthiness so that they don't have high defaults. So that's also interesting. Now, also a thing that I wanted to point out, the company actually raised $150 million last fall in Series C funding, which is quite a lot, as well as $210 million in debt financing. So that's a pretty big raise in a challenging fundraising environment. And they say they became profitable in 2023.
You stole my point. I was like, good point, Mary Ann. How did they raise $150 million as a public benefit corporation in a troubling fintech market? Oh, it's $300 million in annual revenue and positive net income. And if you want to dweeb out with me, everybody, for a second, why do we care that it's net income? Because net income under GAAP regulations, at least, is a much stricter profit metric than EBITDA, let alone adjusted EBITDA. So it's kind of like they're a, well, big boy company sounds oddly gendered. They're a big kid company. There you go.
Yeah, they are. And I think what really drew me to this is I really love it when you can find a company that is doing good and able to make money, build a profitable business. Like, to me, that's just the perfect storm. So I was excited about it, excited to write about it. And, you know, they claim that they're not predatory, right? Because it's always the fear when I hear from lending companies, yeah. Oh, great. Are they just pretending that they're trying to help the underserved, but they're really predatory? And they say, no, that's not what they do, that their loans are interest free. There's no late or hidden fees. They do mark up the price that they charge for the phone by a multiple, but they share the full price up front before customers sign a contract. And the CEO says that users will never pay more than that disclosed amount, and they can return their phone and walk away debt-free at any time.
Okay, I have a clarifying question, because earlier when I was trying to recount the opening anecdote, you were like, kind of, and you're right, because what I missed was she simply didn't have a phone for 9 months. This allowed her to get one, and therefore right. She was back to being connected, but she was still able to get paid in the interim. That was the nuance that I misread during prep. But so let's say I go to pay Joy, and I say, hey, I would like to buy a smartphone. They say, okay. I borrow the money, I get the phone, I pay it off over time. Eventually, I'm square with the company, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what if I want to borrow more money? Does the phone still act as collateral for that second transaction, or do they only do smartphone sales?
No, the phone is the collateral.
So then, do you have to buy a smartphone using them first to generate collateral to take on other loans?
Yes, that's how I understood it. That's a great question. That's how I understood it. You can't just apply for a loan, because that's how they can judge whether or not you're credit worthy, that if you're not a risky bet to loan to.
You know, actually the smartphone as like the unit of backing value makes a lot of sense, because to participate in modern society, in many ways, you have to have one. So folks do. And they are a thing that has discrete resale value, to be clear. And that's all pretty easy to understand. So I can see why that's a good kind of brick to build on from a credit perspective, if you don't have traditional credit scoring available to the underbanked.
Right. I think it's a really fascinating concept. They operate in 7 countries across LATAM, India, Africa, and recently expanded into the Philippines. But I think we probably have to move on, Alex. Am I right?
I have one more thing to say about this. Sorry. Okay. It's a cool company. It's a cool model. You just mentioned Brazil and the broader South American, Latin American region and fintech. Everyone, hold on to that thought, because we're going to come back to that at the end of the show. All right. You want to move on? We shall move on to my deal of the week, which is Proxima Fusion. Just raised $21 million. And this is yet another fusion round. But I'm just so excited to see more capital in the space, Marianne. I love to see new approaches. And here we actually have a spin out from the Max Planck Foundation, which is just super cool. So I'm obsessed about this, and I'm curious, how much can I go on and on and on about fusion before you will begin to shout?
Well, here's the thing. It was definitely over my head, not going to lie. I read Mike Butcher's very well-written story multiple times. Very complex stuff, very cool stuff. But I think we're going to need your help to kind of break it down in everyday language for me and our listeners. But before that, I would like to say $21.7 million for a seed round is a lot.
Yes, but if you have to build things, you have to buy things. I think we're so accustomed to thinking about startups as like 4 laptops, 3 cardboard boxes, 2 interns and a dog, that when you're actually going to go out there and build a fusion thing, you have to have more capital. This is why, you know, I think you've seen some space companies raise like a Series A1 of like 50, so they can actually get that first satellite up, or that first, you know, constellation, whatever. So yeah, I think just different rules on the scale.
Yeah, no, I could see where they would need that much capital, but I was also just impressed by the size of it for a seed round.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, I got too excited about hardware there for a second.
That's okay. Tell us, explain this to me so I can understand it better, Alex, please.
All right, so first, a small correction. It was a spin out from the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics. The Max Planck Foundation helped put capital into the round. I flipped those around in my head. Anyways, there are 2 ways that I kind of understand how to build a fusion reactor. And this is all about working to contain the plasma inside the fusion reactor intelligently to create enough heat to pull off these fusion reactions and to kind of contain it all so it doesn't do something bad and boomy, is my understand. And these 2 methods are called stellarators and tokamaks. So stellarator, pretty phonetic. Tokamak is T-O-K-A-M-A-K. Now, a stellarator is a donut-shaped ring of magnets that has kind of a twist to it, whereas a tokamak, in my understanding, is much more of just kind of a donut-shaped thing. And these are competing approaches to the best way to go about building sustainable and net positive energy fusion reactors. But in the case of Proxima Fusion, there is a further nuance. It is working with stellarators, but it is working on quasi-isodynamic stellarators, which is a subset thereof. And I'm going to go ahead and quote Wikipedia here because I don't understand what I'm about to say, but roll with me. Wikipedia says that a quasi-isodynamic stellarator is a type of stellarator that satisfies the property of omnigeneity, avoids the potentially hazardous toroidal bootstrap current, and has minimal neoclassical transport in the collisionless regime.
Oh my goodness. I did not understand any of that. I will admit it.
I have several physicists in my family. Actually, I'm just going to brag for a second. My brother just defended his applied physics PhD. Wow. That's the second one of those.
Congrats.
I think he was doing lasers. I don't know. Anyways, not this, but I should have called him and asked more about this. But the gist here is that they were working on this type of stellarator at the Max Planck Institute. They've built a relatively large fusion test device. And so this spin out is taking that work that they did there on quasi-isodynamic stellarators and trying to take it to commercial application. And Marianne asked me, when are we going to get this in the market?
Yeah, when are we going to get this in the market, Alex?
Long time from now. Tell you. 2035, maybe? Something like that. I mean, the CEO of the company was like, yeah, you know, we're going to get our prototype done by like 2031.
Wow. Oh, man.
Okay, so this is not agile software development. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, see, I really admire people like that because I don't have that kind of patience. You know, I just want more immediate gratification. So I not only do I admire, of course, like how smart, crazy smart these people are and, you know, how incredible it is what they're doing. But wow, like you're really in it for the long haul when you're planning stuff out for like 10 years later.
Yeah.
Now, they did say to point out that this new approach is only possible because of the ability to use AI to simulate the behavior of the plasma. So that's interesting.
And, you know, plasma is not quite like water. It's much harder to simulate. The thing that I want to throw in before we move on is, yes, this company, Proxima Fusion, is doing cool things. I'm super excited about it. Go Germany, I guess, because this is over in Bavaria or something.
Munich.
But there's a lot of other people trying this. So there are at least 43 other companies working on fusion, according to TechCrunch. And Helion Energy raised a $500 million Series E a few years ago, led by Sam Altman. So lots of people who have a hand in different parts of technology are indeed very hype about this. And I'm just, yes, cool.
Yeah. Also, I mean, VCs are interested in it too. In 2023, nuclear fusion companies attracted over $6 billion in investment. That is 27% more than in 2022.
Which is, I mean, honestly, that means there's multi-billion dollar investment total into fusion startups and, you know, startup-ish companies every year. And we'll have to see what happens in 2024, but it certainly does seem like the momentum is on the side of fusion. And yeah, I buried the lead. If we can get commercially viable fusion to work, and we have shown now that we can do this on a net positive energy basis, then we have so much clean energy. I mean, it would shake up the world overnight forever.
Yeah.
And that's just super, super cool. And I said Bavaria earlier. If you're not familiar with the Bavarian region, Munich is the capital of it. So if you want to put that on a map, that might help a little bit. And if you don't know where Bavaria is, well, play some more Crusader Kings 3 and you'll learn all about it. But when we come back from a very short break, we are going to talk about a couple of very cool startup deals, including where is Beeper going next? What's next in tech? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/TechCrunch. One of my favorite things we talk about on equity that we cover on TechCrunch and that I even see out there in the press, Marianne, is a startup on startup deal. When you see one private tech company pick up another, it's often a way for founders to join forces, build companies more quickly. And these types of transactions are just often strategic and very fun. And that means we get to talk today about WordPress.com's owner, Automattic, buying Beeper for $125 million. Now, Marianne, Do you recall when Beeper was in the news because it pissed off Apple?
I don't recall, but I did read about it in prepping for this. And I thought it was interesting because, you know, there's the whole controversy about iMessage on Android. And I know it was trying to get, like, I think an app so that people on Android could basically message as if they were using iMessage, but then it got killed.
Yep. So essentially, Beeper was trying to break out of the current iMessage versus not iMessage messaging world and bringing that capability to Android. As you can imagine, if you've ever used an Apple product or talked to anyone at that company, they were not enthused by this. Indeed, they were peevish. And actually, Beeper ended up in, I think it was the DOJ's suit against Apple and their walled mobile OS garden. So this is a company that matters. But it sold for $125 million to Automattic, which owns WordPress. And if you were asking yourself, why the frick would Automattic, which makes a CMS that I use for my website, want Beeper? Well, don't forget, it bought text.com last year for $50 million. And we actually had both the CEO of Automattic and the CEO of text.com on the pod to dig into that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So the reason why I found this slightly odd, Marianne, is when they bought text.com, they took that guy and they're like, you're in charge of messaging. And then they bought Beeper. And then they're like, now this guy's in charge of messaging. And if I was the text.com CEO, I would feel ever so slightly jilted.
Yeah, I was a little confused by that. I have to admit, I was like, So now they're claiming, though, that they're going to combine the two to take the best of each company's product and merge it onto one platform. And that text.com is more desktop and iOS centric. They're going to keep those elements of the product. And then the Beeper brand will apply to all of the messaging efforts overall.
Right. So Automattic is going to keep Beeper, kind of like how WordPress is a sub brand underneath it. And so they're building a stable of brands that I think is a pretty cool method as a way to approach the market, especially when we see big tech companies try to slap their name on everything, like, you know, Google this, Google that, Microsoft Office 365, Dynamics Premium Vista, you know, that sort of thing. So it's cool to see smaller, discrete brands kind of persist on. But this is a startup story. Beeper raised $16 million in outside funding, including a relatively modestly sized $8 million Series A from Initialized. So some folks are doing rather well in this, though I presume this was mostly stock and not cash, just because cash is expensive these days and Automattic probably has quite a lot of worth to throw around. But I think, Marianne, you know, I love to see an acquisitive Automattic, and it feels like a win for both the founders here and their investors. So hard to be too unhappy about this.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Beeper's founder said the acquisition came about because it was either time to raise more funding or find a buyer. So, yeah, I think that's pretty interesting that they were like, we'd rather get acquired if we can than have to go out and try to raise more money in this market. So I don't want to say they got lucky, because I don't think this is necessarily a matter of luck or anything, but good for them.
Absolutely.
Sounds like it worked out well. And one thing I didn't realize that also the founder was talking about is that this is really expensive stuff to build.
Absolutely. If you're doing anything that involves sending lots and lots of messages, there's a lot of work to do to make sure all the pipes are connected, and then to pay for the throughput's expensive, and there's compute costs. It's not easy, nor is it simple. And no, you cannot just slap a logo on a Twilio API call and call it a day. So it's tough. But Marianne, this deal is also a little bit reminiscent of what we saw from Proton and Standard Notes. Now, if you've ever used Proton Mail, you are indeed a Proton user, but Proton has other things inside of its world. It is building a alternative suite of privacy-focused digital applications that offer an alternative to big tech. So they have a password manager, they have an email service, they have some online file storage, all stuff you can get from larger companies, but with a privacy focus, Proton, writ large, is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And that's why I thought them buying the smaller Standard Notes, that's the name of the company, was pretty cool. Similarly, yeah. Privacy focused, and they're going to keep the brand.
It is cool. I get excited about M&A. I thought we'd see a lot more of it over the past year and a half or so. So it's cool to see a few deals. I think we talked about another one this week, right? Multiverse acquiring Searchlight as well.
Yeah, but actually that's not even the last one. I mean, we recently had Wonder School in the early day on the podcast to talk about their deal. And I just want to say, when the Beeper CEO said that it was either raise or sell, so they chose one of the two doors in front of them, that's usually the case when a deal happens. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a company is so hot that they get bought just because someone wants to buy their growth, but those tend to be transactions in the 9 and 10 figures, so those have prices attached to them. So I'm just saying, if you sell your company and you're small, we can kind of read into why. So just tell us that. Refreshing honesty is a way to stand out from the crowd.
Yes, absolutely.
But four deals, so automatic beeper after automatic texts, Proton standard notes, Multiverse Searchlight, and then finally Wonder School early day. This is an array of areas. It's messaging and ed tech and blah and blah. It's cool.
And also in February, we talked about, I believe, or maybe we didn't talk about it, but Ivan wrote about it, Notion acquiring privacy-focused productivity platform, Skiff.
Do you use Notion?
It was so weird when I tried to use Notion. I think if somebody like hacked into it, or I don't know what happened. It, long story, I tried to use it, but my family does. Yes.
Your family uses Notion?
Yeah.
For what?
Like to-do lists, stuff like that.
Can you send like your spouse tasks to annoy them?
Well, I could have until I wasn't able to log in because I think I got hacked, but yeah.
Or your son was like, I don't think I want any more tasks from mom. I'm just going to go in there and mess around with her Notion instance. Anyways, I bring all that up because I either need to stop being snarky about Notion and go all in on it, or I can just keep ignoring it. But I just, there's a lot of stuff out there that's like, here's the thing that's going to be your second brain. And then you always have to do all this work to make it actually function. Like,
no, I hear you. I agree. That's why I gave up eventually on it. But anyway, I brought that up as a point of yet another acquisition that happened recently.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to see more deals like this because, as we all know, many startups are struggling to raise capital this year. And that does mean people are going to be looking to find a new home. So cool companies with strong teams, cool products that can either be tuck-ins or simply acqui-hires are going to find a niche. And we shall keep covering these because they are fun. If you are selling your startup, do let us know. We have an email address, which is equitypod@techcrunch.com. Let us know. We'd love to kind of talk to you about it and see why you're selling and why you picked the parent company you did. But on the subject of fundraising, Marianne, I got to spin the globe, leave the United States behind, head towards Latin America, because it turns out if we went there, we would not see Y Combinator.
Well, yeah. So, you know, Anaheim, who's amazing.
The best.
Did some analysis. Yeah, she discovered that in last week's, well, I keep saying last week because that's when the demo days were, but in Y Combinator's winter 2024 cohort, there was only one Latin American company. And I was shocked.
Now, we know of one. There might be one, two, or three.
Yeah, there may be more.
Number is so low compared to prior norms.
Yes, indeed. What we know of is so much less than prior cohorts. Yes. So only one, it was a Brazilian startup called Salvi, a mobile carrier for businesses, that compared to 33 Latin American companies in winter 22. So we went from 33 2 years ago to one. And even in the winter of 2023, there were 10. So actually we went from 33 winter 2022, 10 winter 2023, one winter 2024.
And negative -7 winter 2025, and then negative -30 winter 2026. There, Latin America is going to just owe us fintech startups, I think, at some point in time. And that's the thing that I think is going on here. There's, first of all, fintech, as we have discussed on this show ad nauseum, went up and then it came back down. And as valuations for public fintech companies have compressed, venture outcomes are a little bit harder to achieve. So we have seen a pullback in capital investment to those companies. That means probably, Marianne, fewer fintech startups that YC is looking at. And then also by moving back towards in-person cohorts, refocusing on San Francisco, we are seeing also a more limited geographic footprint. And when you combine the fact that many Latin American companies were fintechs, not a huge shock that the number's down. I will still, though, say essentially zero is a surprise to me, just given the quality of companies we've seen from Latin America.
Right. I mean, it was really low. Like, I can understand it being lower, but not that low. Anna brought up the point that YC kind of also cut down on efforts to incentivize startups from the region. Like, they're not doing these global outreach tours that they were once doing, or maybe they're still doing them, but not stopping like they did in LATAM, like in Brazil and Colombia and Mexico, as in previous years. Also, I don't remember when they switched from virtual to in-person, but maybe fewer founders applied because it wasn't virtual anymore and they didn't want to have to, you know, deal with the expense and headache of coming to the US to participate. So that could be a factor as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to have remote access to your accelerator, you're going to want to go out and find the best of everywhere versus the best of folks who can make it to San Francisco. If I recall, Gary Tan said that every company came to the Bay Area for the latest YC. And I can see this both ways. I absolutely get why YC might want to have everyone in person, because I do think that the best time to have in-person work has been teams that are very small and people are wearing 9 hats and you're trying to iterate very, very quickly. So that makes sense to me. But also, it is a bummer to see fewer folks out there from the world getting into this, because it's a cool way to bring wealth and innovation around the world.
It is. And like you said, I see it from both sides. I don't think that YC is trying to be exclusionary. You know, of course, that's not the reason for it. But in a way, it sort of ends up that way a little bit, just because it can be harder for people or companies in emerging markets to manage that, right? To be able to afford it and do it. But I was curious, because Anna and I chatted about this briefly too, just, you know, what's been going on in the LATAM overall in the world of venture. And so I looked up CB Insights Q1 State of Venture report and found that first quarter, LATAM startups raised a total of about $500 million across 112 deals. Now, dollar wise, it's not that different from last year's first quarter, second quarter, or even fourth quarter. It's very similar. But interestingly, the number of deals is way, way down, like by a lot. So I guess in one sense, that's kind of good, because that means deals are larger. So maybe there's more later stage funding going on in LATAM. But just wanted to point out that there's definitely less money flowing there than there was. Also, I had talked to a Nubank's CEO, David Velez, and he pointed out that, yeah, a lot of the, quote, tourist VCs have left the region. So what's left are the people or the firms that really, really are truly invested in LATAM and didn't just swoop in during the boom era and have now swooped out.
Do you know what the definition of a tourist VC is? Every VC who left right before I did. I mean, right? Everyone likes to talk about tourist money once it's gone. They don't complain about it much when it's there.
True.
Throwing cash around like they're drunk in Vegas. I find that to be a hilariously pejorative term. Aren't all VCs tourists because they're changing up where they're looking and people? And I don't know.
But we did see it. I mean, to his point, we did see like a kind of a surge of like all these global VCs coming into the region, writing checks. And that's definitely slowed down.
That's good. Do you know how small the world is? You can fly around it in like a day.
Yeah, but you know, this again, I have a lot of different feelings about this, but one of the points that you brought up earlier, I do think makes a lot of sense. Fintech hasn't always been big in LATAM because of, you know, definitely a huge need for innovation in there, especially in terms of boosting inclusion. But AI is the hot space right now. And when it comes to AI, like deep tech is not really, you know, happening in LATAM right now, as it is, for example, say here in the US. Like, deep tech companies represent only about 10% of the LATAM and Caribbean startup ecosystem. So even a VC in the region pointed out that, yeah, there's still a ways to go there. So maybe that's part of it too. Just the focus areas there, like where what founders are focused on right now is still playing catch up.
Yeah, I wonder if that comes into play in India as well. Because I was reading some commentary from the Economic Times. I forget which publication, but they were digging into, you know, how much deep tech AI work is being done in India. And I think it was a local founder or a local VC who said, you know, not that much. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing to work on.
Right.
So I wonder if the venture capital world is itself changing its focus a bit until these, I want to say, future proofed or future positive LLMs develop to the point in which they become commodified, and then it'll be more the application layer versus the lower tiers of AI. I don't know.
Maybe.
But if we are seeing fintech decline and Latin America decline at the same time, creating this dramatic decline in fintech LATAM companies in YC, for example, I wonder what other sector and geographic pairings out there are seeing kind of twin declines, like bringing India back up. We know that India's capital investment pace has slowed dramatically. We also know that crypto funding has slowed dramatically. I wonder if like crypto deals in India are especially in trouble.
Well, I would imagine so. And you did raise another good point. I found that fintech funding had reached its lowest level in 7 years in the first quarter. So,
ooh.
Yeah.
What was the dollar amount?
I think it was $7.3 billion, but that counted a $200 million deal from Flexport, which I would not consider fintech just because they do some stuff like around insurance. So more like $7 billion.
Okay. So let's just do some math here. $7 billion. If you hear my keyboard, that's because we do this live on Equity. Let's see. That's $78 million a day flowing into fintech. And that is the lowest amount in 7 years. fintech's doing fine overall, is my read. Like, there's still a lot of money blowing in. It's not entirely out of fashion, you know?
No, not entirely, but, you know.
Marianne, I just have to say, though, I'm tired of these stories in which we talk about how fundraising for a certain region where you and I have met many founders who are super cool is falling off a cliff and doesn't seem to be finding a rebound or a bounce yet. I'm looking forward to when we talk about how, like, hey, Latin American fundraising is really on the way back up and all these cool companies are, you know, accessing so much capital and doing so much. I'm tired of being the sad news kids.
Yeah, me too. I don't enjoy that at all. But you know what? I'm still optimistic about LATAM, and I don't think this means anything too negative long term. It's just a little blip and what's going on there. I think founders are still working hard, still checks going into startups there, and they're just working a little more quietly, I think.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, except for don't be so quiet that we don't know what you're up to. So go ahead and email Marianne if you want to talk to her, because we adore all things Latin America and we answer every email we get. That's a lie. But what's not a lie is that Equity is back on Monday, back on Wednesday, back on Friday. My name is Alex. Marianne is with me. If you want even more from the crew, we are Equity Pod over on X and Threads, and we are TechCrunch Pods over on TikTok. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Equity is hosted by myself, Alex Wilhelm, and TechCrunch senior reporter, Marianne Azevedo. We are produced by Teresa Loconsolo with editing by Kel. Bryce Durbin is our illustrator, and a big thank you to the audience development team and Henry Picavet, who manages TechCrunch audio products. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.